Tom sat round the kitchen table reading Blood Meridian for the third time. Adele placed slices of orange in front of him. "Have you finished, Mrs. Dalloway?" she asked. There was a pause. Always a felt presence between her questions and his responses. Longer now that he wasn't teaching. Finally, he looked up, the novel still open. "Almost." I looked down again, turning the page. How could he say so little? Almost. And that was it. That was all. He had lived with her 15 years. He knew she adored Wolf, especially Clarissa, and all he could say was almost. One word, as if it were enough. Wanting to scream, Adele stood nearly 20 seconds, her hand squeezing the rail of the chair before she sat across from him. He mumbled, or she thought he mumbled, and his carriage hardened because he sensed what was coming. "What do you think?" she asked. He breathed in this deliberate manner that bordered on a groan. "It's a bit slow. The writing is lovely, but Wolf doesn't pull me in," he said, his finger holding his place in McCarthy. "Lovely." She wanted to hit him. She wanted to talk about how the novel slips from the present to the past and back again, how everyone has a point of view, even the girl selling petticoats, how the miracle of existence culminates in Clarissa's at the top of the stairs. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Guild, the podcast of the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. I am your host, Chris Mary Holtman, and I would like to welcome you back into my nook. Today's guest is Chella Corrington. We have a very interesting talk about everything, so it's really fun. And we do make a lot of different references, so you'll just have to look them up. Before, my goal was to write down all the references in the show notes, but I don't even know if anybody looks at them or not. World is still a very, very crazy place. I was quarantined for a little bit on suspicion. Well, people at my work had contracted the virus, but I am free and clear, so that's nice. Gave me a lot of time to sit and write, being isolated like that, away from my family and everything like that. But as I said, I'm good now. So exciting news will be coming shortly. I will try to update my blog this week so that you can go in and look at that. That address is on in the show notes. So, but let's jump right in to talk to Chella Corrington. So at this time, I would like to welcome Chella Corrington to the podcast, into the Nook and into the Guild. Chella, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Christopher. It's in California, Southern California, this time of the year, we have what's called June gloom.
Okay.
And so a lot of fog comes in and settles over us for the morning of the day, and then around 2 the sun comes out.
Okay, so it's a little bit of a, well, I mean, we have that here where I'm, I mean, I live, currently live in Scandinavia and in Sweden, and we have very, very cold evenings and nights. It's kind of like being in the desert. It's weird because we're having wonderful weather, but I'm used to hanging out in Wisconsin, where your evenings are just as nice as your days, and you can sit outside, you can enjoy a beer and talk to your friends, and you don't have to worry about anything other than mosquitoes.
Yeah,
But here it's different. Well, it gets really cold, so in the mornings when you're driving to work, there's this thin layer of mist covering the ground.
Absolutely. that's very much the way it is. And I'm in Santa Barbara, and that's very much the way it is here.
Yeah. And it's magical in a way, and I think it's very inspirational.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love the mist and the fog, and it's great for the plants, and, you know, the flowers are just abundant this time of year.
Yeah.
So jacarandas are just everywhere. It looks purple and white. It's kind of looks like a fantasy world almost.
Yeah. Do you find that that's, do you like to incorporate that into your writing?
Well, kind of yes and no. I mean, I'm originally from the Appalachian South. I grew up in, was raised and grew up in the foothills of North Alabama during the 60s, which was a pretty busy time.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Very dramatic time. And I notice when I'm writing, I do, because often I'll be contrasting the two parts of the country. And so the landscape and the vegetation does figure into my writing, but I'm not a naturalist as such in my writing.
No.
So it does figure into my writing.
Do you ever find that, because I've always been, when I once I started writing and I wanted to get published and stuff like that, I was always looking for that turn of phrase that people will remember you by, you know, that one thing, a saying, you know, when you're watching a movie or watching a TV show and somebody says something poignant, and you know, like I always try to find that. Or I would like to be remembered.
We'll always have Paris from Casablanca.
Exactly. And then you're kind of stuck in there because you obviously, like you said, you can refer to something that is very common or commonplace in where you're at, and you think that, well, that's very profound, but how many people haven't written that exact sentence because they've lived that exact thing? Do you find that that's difficult to do? Are you a poignant looking person?
Well, I think a lot of my work is poignant, and I think a lot of the reason is that I work reminisce and nostalgia into contemporary voice as well. And I think when you look back, there is some sort of poignancy that deepens the median experience. Because I like to play around with time. When I say play around, I try to keep it certainly clear for the reader, but I'm very influenced by Virginia Woolf and the way that she dealt with time. And so I like to play with the past, future, the present, and just kind of always keep the three sort of interacting.
How do you feel about, and that's very interesting because I was just at our local establishment here in the little town that I live, and I was talking to a person. We were just generally chit-chatting. We were talking a little bit, and he's done a lot of research on a very, for this area, famous author named Frank Heller, who...
Well, that name rings a bell. Was he a mystery writer?
He was partially a mystery writer. He would do a lot of, kind of like a Swedish or Scandinavian form of maybe like a Somerset Maugham.
And
he would play around with time a lot. There's a book called The Emperor's Old Clothes, where in the middle of the book, all of a sudden this different story is told that is takes place somewhere completely different, unrelated, but you know there is a relation. You understand later in the book that there's a correlation, but all of a sudden there's like a novel inside of a novel, like a Chinese box. And that always fascinated me. It was always fascinating being able to do that. Is that something that you're cognizant of when you write, that you want to kind of do that, those kind of things? Speaking of just relating to Virginia Woolf, who was very good at doing just that.
Right. I am cognizant of that. I'm probably more aware of slipping back and forth with time rather than just suddenly there we are in the past. But I am very cognizant of the time, the way time is working in my novels or short stories, even in my poetry.
Yeah. It sounds
I do that.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like you're very, and I think that fascinates me, the whole idea of experimental writing, because to me, and I tell my students all the time when we talk about creative writing and fiction, that the novel as a art form is that. It is that experimental, you know.
Right,
challenge the boundaries.
Right. You know, even it's amazing to me because I read more contemporary writers like Italo Calvino, have you read If in a Winter's Night, Traveler?
Yes.
Yes. He plays with time there because he's telling, you know, in 12 chapters or 10 chapters, 10 different stories.
Yeah.
And as they move around. So, you know, I'm very cognizant of how that reflects back on 18th century novels, particularly in the British tradition, when people were beginning to write novels, that they were always breaking the fourth wall. There wasn't a phrase like breaking the fourth wall. No. They were always addressing the reader.
Exactly.
You know, whether you're reading Clarissa or whether you're reading Tom Jones, the author is right there, addressing the reader. So, dear reader, you are brought into this action as much as in 20th century fiction.
Yeah,
and you have that involvement.
Yeah, and
when I first read Calvino, and particularly If on a Winter's Night, I remember people being so astounded the way he started it with, you know, just incorporating his name and saying, now you go to pick up my book or buy my book and where it will be and who's it. And I thought it was the most fabulous beginning of any novel. And it is quite good. But these are sorts of things that writers were doing in the 18th century when they were developing the novel.
Yeah. And I find that people...
You know, which I think is so interesting.
I find that people don't really know their history. I mean, the history of the novel in that case, because I mean, the novel in many ways was when it was created was a mimicry or a mimesis, if you want to use a literary term, to, you know, kind of copying what was popular in the day. I mean, I remember there used to be a show, I think it was on BBC, where they friends, I think they're British actors, I can't remember, but they follow the path of two other authors who've written a book about fishing in England. They wrote it in the early 19th century, and it's all about fishing, and it's all about these fishing holes, these different lakes, but it is an equal parts a story about fishing, but it's also equal parts a story about two friends taking, you know,
right,
a hike with each other. And I always found that people don't really realize that that was what the novel was trying to do. They were trying to mimic this hyper reality. I mean, look at the first novel that was ever written, Pamela, by Samuel Johnson.
Right.
It's all a bunch of letters between the servant girl and her friends, which is basically just telling the story.
Absolutely. And, I mean, he did the same way with Clarissa.
Yeah.
I mean, Clarissa, which is over 1,000 pages, again, it's all in epistolary form.
Yeah.
These were letters to each other. So, yeah, it's what people of the day were doing. You're right. I like that hyper-realism.
Yeah. So you find that, do you try to mimic that when you write? Do you want to try to make a hyper-realistic book when you write?
That's interesting. I guess in some ways I do. My most recent novella is hyper realistic in the, in the terms of being largely modeled on the life of me and my partner, Ted, who's a lot nicer than Tom, I always say. But it is. There is now a kind of vein. I won't call it a genre, but there's a vein. Are you familiar with Ben Lerner or Rachel Cusk? I
No, I
think
don't
Rachel
think.
Cusk.
No, I don't think.
Rachel is a British writer. Ben is American. And they do something called autofiction, which is based on their autobiography, but it's even more heightened, as if you're pulling something from their journal. And they don't even give a pretense of this is fiction with, of course, some of myself included. They call it autofiction, very much based on their life. And as you read it, you get that kind of, at times, I think, unfortunately, fiction as a way, of course, of elevating life as lived. And it can be an extreme, and you think, oh, this could never happen. But at times, Ben Lerner, though, I really admire his work. There are points that I'm thinking, gosh, I'm so embedded in life is lived here. I think that I want to move on at this point. Where is a fictional flourish that can move me on? But I read all of his books, so obviously I'm intrigued by what he's doing.
That's so interesting. I just had a fantasy novel beta read by a couple of other writers because I was thinking of sending it in to a publisher, and I hadn't touched this thing in probably over 10 years. I just sent it to them
Wow.
as it was. And if I figured sometime it's time now to try to make this a reality, because you put a lot of work into a novel, and it would be a complete
Absolutely.
waste. I think my tutor or my mentor when I studied literary, well, because I'm a literary scholar as my base, that's what I was educated as, was my major, and he
That's
said,
cool. I was too, actually.
You know, the worst thing that a writer can do is write and not have anybody read it. That's like the worst
Right.
thing. And so I had these people beta read it, and they said, like, well, yeah, and there's some good things and there's some bad things, but the really poignant part, the really good part, is this part where the main character is talking about how important movement in music is to him.
Oh man, I love
And
that.
then I was thinking about it, and it's just like, that was basically verbatim the last thing my grandfather told me before he died.
Oh, had you brought that in to the fantasy
Yeah,
at any
exactly. And
point?
that kind of hit me there, that even though you're writing fantasy, the hyper-realism can still be there just as long as it's true.
Right. And I think that's lovely, and it's very poetic too. Music being so close to poetry, I think that fiction, I'm more comfortable with getting at the heart of truth in fiction than I am in nonfiction, because I like that little bit of veneer protection.
And
In a way that with nonfiction, I'm just saying, here it is.
And I think
This is
that
my life.
I like that's why I kind of to me, I mean, two of my favorite writers were Garrison Keillor is one of my favorite writers, and he does that. I mean, he brings a non-fiction or a fiction style storytelling to non-fiction. You know,
Right.
he presents it as non-fiction, although it is all fiction. And at the same time, on the other hand, you have Eric Larson, who wrote Devil in the White City, where it's basically nonfiction, but he creates a fictionalized story of nonfiction events.
Now, I'm not f familiar with him, and I should probably be. Eric Larson.
Yeah, he wrote Devil in the White City, I think was his big book, his most famous work, which is half of the story is about the World's Fair in Chicago and the
Oh,
background to
what was
that.
that, 1938 or something?
I think it was earlier than that,
Okay.
because the second part is about Henry Holmes, H.H. Holmes, the serial
Yeah.
killer who killed all the people in his murder mansion. So, and that was during the World Fair. So it's all about,
Gee.
and he weaves this great tapestry and tells a fictional story based in things that are real. Because obviously you don't know what these people told each other. You can't really know what H.H. Holmes' actual motives were. You can only try to understand it. And that fascinates me a lot.
I was saying that a friend of mine is doing a series of novels about Jack the Ripper in the 19th century, but she's also weaving the history of homosexuality at that time into her novels. So her novels are very much based in history, but of course there's that fictional element too, as you say. You can only speculate. Well, that's what E.L. Doctorow does.
Yes,
I mean, have you,
I love
and Ragtime.
Doctorow.
I love him.
I
You
love
know,
him
he,
too.
and well, there's a great quote that someone was complaining at a reading that he was tampering with historical fact. And he said, my novels aren't in history. My novels are in fiction.
Yeah.
And he began to explain how he uses history as a backdrop. So
Yeah.
I think I like that a lot too.
Yeah. No, that is fascinating. So how did you start writing? Where does your writing vein come from? Your want to express yourself?
I think that mine really started, as I say, I grew up in the Appalachian South, is foothills of the Appalachians in North Alabama, and lived there until I was about 18 or 19. And people in that area are storytellers. I mean, it's not a very, in terms of formal literacy, you don't have a high level, but you do have a lot of great storytellers. And as a kid, I can remember just, going over to my neighbors and their granddad being there and just entertaining me. It just sounds like such a cliche, but just entertaining me, us, with stories. And I just enjoyed that. And then I was kind of a shy kid, and I always kept journals. And I guess my first kind of writing was poetry. And that was probably in the 7th or 8th grade. And I continued to write poetry. I didn't really write fiction until maybe I was in my early 30s. But I had the good fortune of studying, I don't know if you're familiar with, but with James Dickey. He was old by the time that I studied with him, but he was a wonderful Southern poet. He, probably what an audience at some point would have remembered him for was the novel Deliverance that was made into a movie. This must have been 30, 35 years ago. But it was, so I studied poetry with him and just continued to write. And I've only lived in California for 18 years, my partner and I. 18 years ago, he's from the Midwest. I'm from the South. We were both teaching in the South at the time. He said, "Let's go to a different part of the country. What's it like?" And he'd just been to a conference in California. Go west, young people, go west. So we came to California, and there is some truth there with that kind of movement away from roots and family and people and things you've known all your life, that there's a kind of reinvention of yourself. And so we both started writing a lot with this move. And comes, my husband is an economist, and I had a background in literature and writing and academic writing. But we started, he's a fiction writer and I write fiction. He also writes plays and poetry. And we just sort of reinvented ourselves as writers while teaching. So that's entering more than you asked, but no. Those are the roots and those are where they've led.
And when did you decide to start, you know, pursuing publishing? Because I talk to a lot of writers, and I would probably say that I think the majority of people that I talk to on this podcast are very recent writers. They haven't been writing for very many years, and that whole, because of that, they probably got into a climate where there's a lot of avenues to get published, even though it doesn't mean that it's easier by any stretch of the imagination. But because there is a greater, there are a lot more indie companies, there are a lot of more people looking to publish writers, and especially in short story anthologies, it's probably a different time. From when I was younger, when I was starting out, that was impossible.
Right.
And for many years, probably hid until just recently when I decided I would take a chance. But how was it for you? I mean, how long did it take for you to start pursuing being published?
Actually, when I really turned my a lot of intensity toward creative writing, which was 10 years ago, since I'd been doing academic writing, and when you're in academics, you're constantly sending things out because promotion depends on it, that I did have a habit of sending things out. So I was one of those people who is sending things out way before I should have been.
Mm.
You know, I should have sat on some of my pieces and revised them. That's something that is an aspect of writing I had to learn. Just through more writing, through some rejections, through some comments from editors, I needed to do more revision, more sitting on the piece before sending it out. But the sending it out was never a problem, and I think that just comes out of that academic tradition. Is if you want promotion, you've got to have an article in Samuel Johnson or some or Virginia Woolf, or you know.
Mm-hmm. And when did you, so what did you pursue first? Did you start by sending out short stories and anthologies? Because, I mean, like you and
I started poetry in journals.
Because I said this on the last episode with K.M. Bennett, that when I started writing, I just thought that you write a novel, you send it out, they accept it or they reject it, just like you. I didn't know that you were supposed to sit on it and edit it and do one first draft, second draft, third draft. I just thought that once the story is done, you send it out. And I had no thought that. I always thought novel first, short stories later. I mean, then you can make a short story anthology. And then, I mean, I had to learn the hard way that wasn't at all the way the cookie crumbled. So you started by poetry.
I started with poetry, and I started sending to literary journals. And well, this must have been longer than 10 years ago, because when I started sending, the online journals weren't as well regarded as they are today.
No.
It was still the print journal that was so regarded. So I would always pursue the print journal. But things really have shifted and changed. And a lot of that has been, I mean, we have a lot of quality online journals, and also in the last 10 years, I would say the way or the people read on a whole has sort of shifted. You know, they like sort of the computer screen sized works. I think that's how flash fiction's become so popular too.
And this is, I think it's the same with Drabbles, the 100-word short stories, because that was nothing that I had actually even heard of or contemplated until I saw my first call for it and decided to try it out.
Try one. So I started with poetry. I started with print journals. Now I do print and online journals. I still love literary journals and just sending things out, 3 to 5 poems or 2 to 3 pieces of fiction at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then collecting those.
And when did you decide to get your hand on writing a full length novel and try to send that out? What can you tell us a little bit about that process?
That process for me, it's actually a flash novella, and I'm going to give myself a little promotion here. The title of my flash novella is Adele and Tom, The Portrait of a Marriage. And one of my friends was saying, God, the cover of your book looks like a regular romance. It's not really. Yes, it's 2 middle-aged people who are still in love, but it's really about Adele's struggle with aging, with life, with her writing, with wanting to have a kid. It's these kinds of issues that are relevant always, I think. And you get Tom's story too, but I think it's largely Adele's story throughout. So I started writing. I came up with a character that I liked. I liked Adele. Mm-hmm. And Adele was a little bit of me. And I started writing short pieces. And the nice thing, I don't know if your audience is aware of flash, but it's like you were talking about the Drabbles, that flash is a short piece of narrative or fiction that can be read and flat in a flash, or as Smoke Long Quarterly likes to say, it can be read in the time that takes a smoker to smoke a cigarette. That's not politically correct anymore, but to say that maybe, but that's the way I think Smoke Long started.
I think about three minutes and 40 seconds, I think, when I smoked. That was basically the length of a song by the Scottish band Delamitri was basically what I timed it out to be.
Oh, that makes absolute sense. And so most of these pieces that I gathered together for Adele and Tom are standalone pieces that I had published in journals. And finally I thought, why don't I put this together as a novella? My writer friend said, novellas don't, people aren't interested in novellas and they want novels. And I understood part of where they were coming from. However, I have enjoyed novellas. I love a short novel called The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. I love Billy Budd. I love The Turn of the Screws. So I thought, well, some people have done with novellas, and I just began collecting and gathering and then writing. Then I began writing to the novella. I need a couple of flashes on Adele's good friend Anna, and so I would write, and then it came together. I wasn't in a rush. It wasn't quickly. This all came together probably over about a 3-year period.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's been, and I think I'll probably do another novella. I would like to do it the same way with The Flash. And I must say, this one, as I mentioned earlier, Adele and Tom, It's very auto-fictive. This is largely based on the life of me and my partner Ted. But then I've added fictive flourishes and elaborated in places. So, but if one knew us, one could see elements of our lives reflected in the novella. But the next novella that I'm working on, and I've only done maybe 5 chapters, it's again about a woman who moved from the South, the Appalachian South, to California. But it's more of a woman's world. She is more interested in developing her life around women. There's a lot of comparison and contrast of California and the South as it was when she was growing up. My ideal or my hope is always, has always been to write a Southern novella that's not cliche. I think there's so many cliches, and because when people, oftentimes, it strikes me that when readers pick up something that's written about the South, they expect gothic weird stuff. Even this wonderful book that I read, and she writes very well. I probably won't remember her name, but Where the Crawdads Sing, it was very popular. And a woman, this woman writer has a great deal of knowledge in plants and etymology, and but she also has that really weird factor. Her protagonist is, and you probably go, yeah, that's those are the things that happen in the South. It's like seeing Billy Bob's Sling Blade and going, yeah, it's exactly what I expect. But that happens with regions, places, whether it's within the United States, outside of the United States, it just seems so much easier for if movies or novels are trying to reach a fairly commercial audience to kind of play on a cliche about the area or place.
Yeah, I think so, and that's what's so interesting, because I've tried to put my home my homepage for my fiction is called Wisconsin Noir, which is supposed to be kind of like dark stories set in Wisconsin in the Midwest,
Right.
which I try to kind of is basically just supernatural stories or crime fiction that is set in the Midwest, because I found that there isn't that much that is actually set in the Midwest. And I think I was talking to Jennifer Gordon about that, because she obviously lives in in New England, which is
I'm
steeped in
very,
all
yes.
kinds of Gothic fiction, has a
Right.
rich tradition of that. But I think it's d difficult, and I think that's, yeah. So you have this to contend with, the South, American Gothic, South Gothic, everything that that entails with everything that's on TV, for instance, too.
Sure.
But the Midwest, I've always found it to be a little bit of a, where's the identity in the Midwest? And I you struggle with that sometimes, I think.
Sure, that's an excellent point. Didn't Hemingway, with his early stories, try to do something like that for Michigan?
Yeah, I think so.
Tried to develop it in Michigan. And then you have the stories. Oh, God, there's another. Winesburg, Ohio. He tries to. Sherwood Anderson. As you might want to look at that, I think he does a pretty good job of setting up a kind of area and working in his Winesburg, Ohio.
Yeah.
So there, but they're not very many, you're right, they're not very many Midwestern that you can think of. I mean, you can think of Faulkner because he set that imaginary area. I think Faulkner for the South probably does the best inclusive job, I think, of Southern writers.
Yeah.
I mean, he's concerned with the language. I mean, he's concerned with, he understands his characters. There's not that diminishing of characters in the way I think that you see in somebody like Flannery O'Connor. While she can be entertaining, I think that there's just a certain disregard for characters, poor whites, blacks, that I don't find is rich. I even with the bad characters, I want some sort of empathy,
Yeah.
and that's my taste.
Yeah. And I mean, I think of that because I think Garrison Keillor probably is a
Right.
good Midwestern writer, but the characters seem a little, they're foolish, they're naive, there isn't that great a depth to them. And the same with August Derleth, who was a Midwestern writer and set his a lot of stories in Wisconsin, but still, that's basically just slice of life, almost more nonfiction than they are any real fiction story. So there's a lot of things there that could definitely be better. But I mean,
Right.
so when you talk about writing a Southern story that is devoid of cliches, are you talking about avoiding the cliches completely or turning them on their head?
Kind of turning them on their head. I mean, I'm sure that I can't avoid them completely, but I want to show a slice of Southern life that is not often seen. I think you'd get a little bit of that, but I think the film version in Fried Green Tomatoes, the novel. So I want to show aspects and slices of Southern life that aren't revealed often to us. And that's difficult to do.
I did
You know, I
that.
just realized that. Of course, I think, and you may think the same thing when you're being in Sweden, it must be easier in some ways to analyze and to think about the kinds of things that you want to do in your Wisconsin writing,
Yeah,
because you have that distance.
absolutely. Because every time I go back, and I go back every so often, I mean, try to do it with at least every other year, go back and visit family and hang out. And there's always something new, a new nuance that you pick up, and there's just something that you
Yeah.
didn't realize. Oh, that's the way they say that, or that's the way they think about that. And I think that you incorporate that into your writing all the time is a new facet.
That's right. And I think that that's the way I feel too about going back to the South, which we won't be doing for quite a while because we're not too enamored to get on the train right now.
No,
Neither do we
exactly.
want to drive the 2,000 miles across. But yeah, you go back and I didn't notice that. Oh yeah, I could bring this in.
So how
So you
did
always have that new experience when you return.
You go about getting Adele and Tom published? What was that process like in
I sent it out to several publishers, maybe, I want to say, two handfuls, probably 10. And it was not, I sort of have a limit. If I go beyond, say, 10 or 12, I sit back down with it and think, what am I doing here? What do I need to be doing? What am I doing that the reader expects? And I had a couple of publishers say, God, I like this. It's new. I understand. They got what I was doing. And one of the things in this novella that I'm doing, it's kind of like John Gardner's approach to pointillistic fiction, that it doesn't have the traditional narrative arc, but each piece stands on its own. But then when you pull back after reading the novella, you get a sense of direction. It's like a pointillistic painting. If you're up close, all you see are just the little dots. But the further back, you see the total image. So, you know, some of the publishers got it, and the ones that got it, I started negotiating with. And I felt with Breaking Rose Publishing that it would be, I felt that the negotiations were the best. I liked the way that Christopher Clausen Rule, who is the publisher, projected a real sense of writer community. And the writers, the authors are very supportive of each other, were very good about publicizing others' books, which I think has been a great boost to sales and to getting our names and our work out there. So I went about, you know, I did not go through an agent with a novella. I just went to independent publishers. The limit was 10. I had two that I was negotiating well with. And because of community support, and I like the way they did the publicity and the author community, I went with Breaking Rose Publishing. So that was my decision there. And it's been a good decision. I mean, yeah. I've worked with good authors like Jennifer Gordon and Allison Hubbard. And, you know, there is a tie there and a strength of sort of keeping tab with each other on where we are, what we're doing, and just keeping each other motivated. And helping when we can. They're very good with graphics. I'm not as good, so they've been very good with me with graphics. With my novella, I do something that I think is interesting, and I've gained a fair amount of followers with this, is that each week I read a couple of chapters from my novella and posted on my Facebook page. And then I need to go for shorter, less than a minute, which I'm in the process of doing, and sending it out to Twitter and to Instagram. And a lot of people come in, oh, that was great, I like that. So then I decided last week that I would open it up to guest readers. So those who have bought the novel and are keeping up with it, I said, does anybody want to be a guest reader? Just message me. And this morning I realized I had my sixth message. So alternate readers will, alternate weeks will have different readers. So that's fun.
Yeah, that's nice. And it's fun too that I guess the Breaking Rules kind of like allows that. In a way, so that it doesn't become like we own the rights to this, or we're the publisher, so we kind of decide what you can and can't do.
Yes, their Breaking Rules is very good in giving you leeway on things that you want to try and new things.
Is there a demand from them or what they expect you to do? Is there a minimum of this? We need you to be doing this.
There is a minimum. I mean, and again, it's this helping your the other authors at publishing, Breaking Rules Publishing, to be seen and heard. And Christopher came up with work in groups of five or six. And we have a meeting each week on Zoom. And each day of the week, one author will be featured. So you are, the other writers are to publicize that author on their social media outlets. So that's a responsibility that you have to the group each week, is to publicize their work, you know, not heavy-handed, but the author, for instance, I would send the graphics that I have that they could use on Twitter, they could use on Instagram. I would send a reading that I have they could use on Facebook. I haven't tapped in enough yet to YouTube, which I should do. But so there's a responsibility to support the other authors you're working with.
This next, we say novella all the time, and I'm thinking it makes me think more about chap books, like the old chap books, than novellas. But this, because that I think is seems to be coming back. There are quite a few independent publishers that put out chap books, you know, short fiction, and I think it's kind of fun that is coming back, because obviously when you study literature at the university, a lot of times you have to read chapbooks, old chapbooks. But this next one is the idea that once that's finished, that it's going to be it's Breaking Rules Publishing putting that one out too, or are you going to shop that around, or I mean, how does that work?
Well, probably. You know, I'm not sure yet. You're talking about my next novella?
Yeah.
I'm not sure yet how I'm going to. Right now, I'm just in the process of writing. So I may shop that around. I don't know. You know, it's just, I'll just have to wait and see. In the process now, I have several chapbooks of poetry, and a couple of publishers have contacted me about putting out a full-length chapbook of poetry.
Okay.
Because, and so I may be working on that for a while too. Chapbooks are very good and very popular, and I do love them, because the chapbooks that I buy, the authors can, they can stay consistent, they can develop a theme, they can, it's just, you can read it in a sitting. Again, it's just a delightful vehicle, I think, for, I've seen it more with poetry, but for fiction too.
Yeah.
Like one story that comes out is not a chapbook, but they print out every other month one story by someone. It's a journal. So, you know, with chapbooks, I love chapbooks, and I'm sure I'll be doing more. I have 9 chapbooks. 6 are poetry, and 3 are flash fiction. And then my novella. And I've worked on some plays. My husband's a playwright too, so we've done a couple of plays that we've produced. But largely I stay with fiction and poetry. So I see more chapbooks in my future. I see a full-length poetry book in my future. And then where this novella ends up, I'm not sure.
No, I think it's not really like it used to be, where authors stayed with one publisher, and maybe it is if you're with a bigger publishing house.
Right.
But it feels like
top
it's
5 or something.
Yeah. But I mean, it feels like it's different now that you basically don't stick with one publisher. You're not contracted to write 3 books of fiction over
right.
a certain amount a period of time. It's more or less like, I'm done with a book, now I can shop it around to the next, and maybe the publisher that published my last book is interested in this one as well, but it's not
right.
guaranteed.
Absolutely. In fact, each of my chapbooks have been published by a different publisher, some of which came about through contest, some of which came about just through submission. So in that case, I've just done, and I kind of like working with the different publishers because they all have, you know, they have a different focus, or some may be really interested in the visuals. There was a publishing company, Indigo Inc., that was very much interested in trailers and did just beautiful trailers for the poetry books. There was another publishing company that the artist for the cover of the chapbooks was just phenomenal. And you know, all sorts of things like that. So it's kind of fun and interesting. And it's a learning experience to go with a different publisher, just to see what their publishing focus is, what they're looking at, how they're putting it together.
No, that sounds No, that's interesting. I guess I don't really know where I fall yet. Because I haven't had a full length novel published yet, but I guess if it's a part of a series, like a fantasy series, I probably would like to stick with the same person, because if he, I have a friend, Bradley Beaulieu, who is actually a Midwestern fantasy author, although his books do not take place in a fantasy Midwest, but his first trilogy that he wrote, the first two books are with the same publisher, and then the third book is with a different publisher, which makes it very difficult for him because he can't. It's not always easy to fulfill that entire trilogy, because maybe the last publisher is not printing any more copies, so you're kind of stuck. You're kind of stuck there.
Am I correct? And I think friends that I've talked to that usually, it's very difficult if you're doing a series and say you have three or four books in a series and you start with a publisher, you usually try to keep that sequel with that publisher. Because for the reason that you mentioned and for other reasons, that it's just hard to market a broken sequence.
Yeah.
So you have the first book with one publisher and then you have two and three somewhere else. That's just hard to market.
Yeah, and I had a friend. I have a friend here in Sweden who published his first piece of fiction with a publisher. And it did fairly well. And then when he was going to sit down and write the sequel to it, because there was never talk about it being like more books in a series, but he got the inspiration and he figured, you know, I'll write a sequel because I got the feel for it, but they dropped him, so now his sequel didn't have any. So now he has a sequel. I don't actually know if he's done with it, if he finished writing it, or if the wind got knocked out of him or whatever. But that's kind of strange, because it wasn't like they even gave him a chance,
right, for the sequel. I mean, that is strange. Did they give him any reason?
I just don't think that the first book sold enough. I think that was just the thing of it. It didn't sell enough. I would say that it partially because they didn't market it enough, like that. So I can't say that it was particularly his fault. I think it was more or less that it didn't have the reach. And I mean, Sweden is a difficult market as well. Sweden is very, still very, just regular fiction, literary fiction oriented. It's, these kind of like, unless you write crime fiction, publishers are very, very uninterested in publishing, genre fiction, science fiction, fantasy, and stuff like that.
Why did you wind up in Sweden from Wisconsin?
Well, my dad's Swedish, my mom's from Wisconsin, and my wife, who's also from Wisconsin, was interested in studying here. And since we were a couple, she could come, and I'm a dual citizen, she could come over to Sweden and
That's so cool.
study at the university for free. And we did. Plans were only to stay here for a year, and then it just kind of, we settled down. You get an apartment, and you don't really understand that you have a lease that you have to have. You have to give a 3 week, 3 months notice. Which is the rules here, and then you're kind of stuck, and then everything in the States happened. George Bush got into power, and all that, and the situation in the States was just like, this is not a place where we want to raise kids.
And we thought at one point when George Bush got into power that that was not so good.
Yeah.
And now looking back, we think, oh my God,
It was better.
it was better.
Yeah,
It was so much
so right
better.
now, going back to the States isn't really an option for us because we have kids, and we're kind of trying to raise them here, where you have free education and free maternity leave and free paternity leave and sick leave and insurances and stuff like that, free health care, and that's kind of
That
like
sounds fabulous.
and that's kind of what has to take precedent now.
Right. It sounds absolutely fabulous. Maybe we'll come over and live with you.
Yes, we have a spare room in the house, so that's fine. Okay, but our time here is actually winding down. So Chella, where can one find you? You were talking about Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If people are interested in connecting with you and seeing what you're doing, what you're up to, where can they find you?
Well, my author page is my name, Chella, Chella Corrington, Corrington .net, all lowercase. You can go to the author page. I'm on Facebook. You can just look me up by my name. I don't go by any pseudonyms. I'm on Twitter, and it's at Chella Currington with the N on Currington left off. I mean, I just use Chella Currington everywhere. I don't use a mask name, or it just to me makes it easier. And same at Instagram, Chella Currington lowercase run together. But I would like for people to come in and just listen to maybe a reading of Adele and Tom on my Facebook page, because maybe that will, I just would like to share my work. It's fun to have people come in to hear their comments. And of course, they can find the novella on Amazon in Kindle for under $3, or if they have a Kindle account, I think you can get X. If you read so much, or I don't have that extended account,
That
but
Kindle
I think,
Unlimited.
yeah, that you can get it. It's part of the your price there in your account. So you can get paperback or Kindle at Amazon, or you can get it at Breaking Rules Publishing. The thing is, my friends tell me it just comes so much quicker from Amazon. That is the only problem or issue. That's not a problem.
Can you find it at Barnes and Noble?
I don't know if you can. But I know that if someone were listening from Santa Barbara, they can find it at Chaucer's bookstore.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember I was talking to Aaron Liebold, who's also a
Yeah.
Breaking Rules author, and we were talking about, because I mean, obviously, if you were to self-publish, I mean, Barnes and Noble has their own self-publishing service, just like Amazon has. And he was talking about Borders might even have, which is the Canadian bookstores.
Oh.
But I mean, I've seen the books that I am featured in, the various short story collections and anthologies. I think there's only two of them that are available on Barnes and Noble. The rest are just Amazon all the way.
Yeah, I should check. Well, I wanted to ask you, are you gonna read a little from Adele and Tom?
I always start each
You'll
podcast
read
with a
it before
reading.
the interview.
Yeah.
Great. Because you have such a good reading voice.
Oh, thank you.
I look forward to hearing you read it.
Yeah, thank you.
That's why I sent you that particular section.
I was told by a musician once. He wanted me to read in he did a piece of music, and he wanted me to do a reading from Ray Bradbury, and I think that's when I realized that he said, "Oh, you have such a good reading voice. You should just, you know, can you read this section in the middle of the song or in the middle of the music? Just kind of do a reading."
And oh, so that's great! How, did you?
Yes, I did. I don't know whatever happened to that piece of music. It was days before streaming services.
Right.
So I didn't even know if that piece of music is even around anymore.
You know, that's what the Beats used to do, which is great. They do a lot of jazz, and then they read in Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and all those guys. Would read, and then have chat. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played around with that a little, but I haven't done a lot with that.
Yeah, I remember. There used to be a literary journal where I went to high school, where they had where they would do that. They would just read the part of the literary journal would be read to jazz music.
Well, see, that's fun. I think all of this should be fun.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, as writers, when you're in the process, you love the process of writing, or many writers do. I do.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm doing it. I do love the process, but I want to get it out there, and I want to get it heard by people, and I want to have fun with it. You know, it's just, that's what life is about. It's about being productive, but it's also, the fun is enjoying, is really
the
synonymous to me, to enjoy what you're doing and when you're out there. And it's just great.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I completely agree. And I think that's something that I've had to learn through time. Because I think I was, early on, I was one of those writers that liked to write and would sit in my room and be more upset that nobody discovered me, where I didn't actually, even though I didn't put anything out. And I'm just like, I'm so much better than that guy, but I wasn't doing anything to promote my own work. And
yeah.
I would just sit on it.
Yeah.
And as we said at the top of the show,
Dickinson.
Yeah, at the top of the show, we were saying that this is, that's like the worst thing that you can do, is just keep it for yourself. Because a writer writes for a reader, for an audience.
Right, right. You have to have some sense. And not that you're writing for every audience, and not that you have maybe particular audiences you're writing for, but you want a reader. It's a way of communicating.
Yeah.
You know, it's been such a thrill and a point of thriving for both me and my partner that we're both writers.
Yeah.
So we're each other's first reader.
Yeah.
And we trust each other eminently. And so you can say, well, this is a pile of shit, but he's more diplomatic than that.
Yeah.
And he says, you've got to get your care. He's kind of like Tom a little bit, and Adele and Tom. You need to be more external. My characters tend to be a little bit internal.
Yeah.
Sort of like Stephen Mulhouse, or a little bit like Wolf, that they go inward a lot.
Yeah.
And but having your alpha reader at home is fabulous, and we do it for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. My wife tends to read. She's not a writer per se, but at all. But she tends to read most of the things that I write. Not everything. She has a particular, you know, genre that she likes, or I can trust her to understand what it is I'm writing when
right.
I come to those genres. And then there are the things that I felt that she can read and comment on the context and the style and the emotions, but maybe not the literary, the form that it is in, or the genre that it is in. So, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's what you want. You won't read a response.
Yes.
Because when your work is out there, that's, and those are going to be your readers.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's good to have someone in the house you can trust to give you reaction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's the ultimate trust there, that you get a fair and balanced opinion.
Right. Absolutely.
That's important. And that the person that is reading also can trust that you're going to take it for what it is and not get sour because you feel like you wrote something really good and now you're just tearing it down.
Absolutely. You know, I have a lot of friends who I think are good writers, that never get their stuff out because they really can't bear rejection.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of thicken your skin a bit, or you have to realize that rejection is part of every writer's journey.
Yes. Nobody gets accepted all the time. That's just how it is. And even if you do get, you get your first manuscript accepted, you're going to get rejected eventually. I mean, nobody is perfect, hits a perfect home run all the time. And whether that be that you don't get enough readers, if people pan your novel or whatever it is, there's always going to be a bump in the road. And it helps you grow. I think that's what the important part is. You deal with rejection in a way, you have to deal with it right, because it makes you grow.
Surely, you grow through it and you learn how to handle it. And it just makes you a stronger writer, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Chella, it has been a treat. It's been lovely to talk to you. And I hope you... Yeah, you can continue.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I hope you'll come back and talk to us when you put out a new chapbook or novel.
I would love to. I mean, I would love to come back and talk about poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because I feel that's very much part of who I am as a writer, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Christopher, so much for having me. I'd heard great things about you, particularly from Jennifer Gordon, and I listened to you a couple of the interviews, and I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you.
Yes, it's been lovely. It's been such a great time. It's always fun to and especially when it's so seamless and effortless to get a conversation going.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
It's like you put two writers together who have some good reading background, and hey, you got it going.
Yes, exactly.
Do you ever run into writers who say, I love to write, but I do not like to read?
I do. I actually have. I think there are a couple of interviews there where there are people that have said that. I'm not much of a reader, but I love to write.
And then, I don't understand that, Christopher. Can you explain that to me?
I don't know if I can explain it, but I believe it is because a lot of times they don't want to get, it could be that they're not particularly strong readers, that it takes a lot of energy for them to read, that they don't have the time to read. They want to put more of their effort into writing. But then also that there's a lot of people that don't want to get their writing colored by what
that
they read.
I can understand.
So I think
I'm always writing for it. That's an interesting approach. And I mean, there are many approaches to being a writer. I'm often reading for the story or having fun, but too, when I'm writing, I'm also reading because it becomes a trigger or a muse or an inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was talking to, when I was interviewing K.M. Bennett, we were talking about, because I read a lot of times the people, the stories, the authors that I read have very little to do with the type of genre that I'm writing at the moment.
Right.
And I'm reading mostly because I want to know how they tackle dialogue, how they tackle setting, how they tackle description. So So that they're for like writers like Dan Simmons or Garrison Keillor or Eric Larson, who write more of realistic fiction or literary fiction, works better because I want to see how they incorporate that kind of description or that kind of dialogue and how I can use it in my more genre fiction.
Absolutely.
So.
Those are my key words, and those I've said right or absolutely every a lot. I do the same sort of reading. Like I tend to work interiorly, and there's a wonderful new book I just ordered, read a great review on it. Paris, 7 a.m. by Lisa Wieland, and she speculates about how Elizabeth Bishop, the poet, spent a week, I think, maybe more, in Paris. But it's a very interiorly told novel, and that's kind of what I'm working on and interested in now, sort of the interior voice.
Well, I did that when I was writing the book I'm editing now, which partially takes place in Bali, before right before the war in the Pacific, and so I read Jane Gardam's Old Filth, which is about an old man. It kind of is mostly told through. It's told a lot through flashbacks of this old English gentleman who used to be a judge in Hong Kong, and kind of
Gee,
like
that
how,
sounds interesting.
and I just love the way she balances the flashbacks of being in Hong Kong to his situation after his wife dies, and how he live
Wow.
how he comes to terms with that. But it's a very good book. And
Oh,
that's
I'll have to
kind
write that down.
of, yeah, but as I said, I hope you will come back and talk to us some more. We have every once in a while round table discussions, and hopefully that you can come and we can get a round table discussion about poetry going, and like to
That. That would be super.
invite you to
So,
that.
should I just contact you and
No,
say
I'll
when you
contact you
contact?
when I can get a group together to do that.
Okay, great. I would love that. Absolutely. Well, this has just been wonderful, and I so thank you for including me on your show. Such a great honor, and so fine talking to you.
It's been my pleasure, and it's been my honor for having you on. You have a great day.
Okay, you too. And hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Welcome back. A great interview. As always, so much fun. If you happen to be an author, a writer, or a creator of any kind and want to talk about something that you've just written, something coming out, please contact us either through the Facebook page, through Instagram, or through Twitter, and we will set something up. I mean, this is as much a podcast for you to get your message out there, or you might want to talk or plug something, as it is for me. So, I would like to thank everybody for listening. Please share, tweet it out, Instagram it out, Facebook it out, whatever you do. I'd also like to thank Jella Corrington for coming on the show, and also like to thank the music writer John Holzman for providing music for today's show. That was all for this time. As I said, check out the blog for updates on what I'm doing. And stay safe. I'll talk to you next time.